Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. This is your host, Len Osanek. Today, we are speaking with author Richard Otto. Hello, Richard.
How you doing, Len? It's an honor to be on your show.
Well, thank you. It's great that you have published a book, Rethinking America, Lies Masquerading as Truth, that I have found very interesting. You know, when I get a lot of books, I don't want to make excuses, but I get a lot of books to read, and you know, there's a lot of things happening, so I don't get to them right away, and I must not have gotten to this book for a little while, but I'm very happy I did. And once I started reading it, I actually get the PDF and I put it into my phone and I play it as an audiobook, and it plays like that. And then when I'm driving or stuck in traffic or doing whatever, I get to listen to books that way. My God, when I was going through this, I kept thinking, this sounds just like me. I had the same opinions you had, and it was kind of uncanny. As I kept going through the book on different topics, and I felt right at home, you know. And then I started thinking, well, there's going to be something I disagree with the guy on. Come on, you know. So I'm looking for, you know, problems, right? But I didn't find anything worth mentioning. So, and I was reading it to learn. I was reading it to, you know, and listening to someone else's point of view. And it just seemed that, you know, and I think maybe people listening to Black Op Radio will share a similar view as me, but, you know, in the ballpark. This is why I wanted to have you on to talk about this and help publicize it. First of all, I guess I'll just ask you, what motivated you to write a book? I mean, it's one thing to be interested in history and read, but then when somebody decides to pick up a pen or get behind the keyboard, something really moves them. And that's what I usually ask first of an author.
Well, the more I started to research our history, I read a lot about the Founding Fathers, the Indian Wars, and then I really got into the growth of our national security complex since World War II. I read a great book by Carroll called The House of War that really stirred my interest in what was going on in the country and how our military-industrial complex, as Eisenhower referred to it, I refer to it as our national security complex, how it dominates our foreign policy and has tremendous impact and influence even on our domestic policy. And essentially, we've become a threat to world peace, as opposed to the message that obviously President Kennedy had, which was to try to achieve peace in our time, if not for all time. And the more I heard the mainstream media discuss these issues, like, for example, the PBS NewsHour would have somebody from the CIA come on the show. They might discuss something that was like involved in intelligence. And it would be a subject that I had just researched and read a whole book on and stuff. And these guys weren't touching on any of the important factors that I had read about that had shocked me and really enlightened me about what's going on under the umbrella of national security in this country. And I began to research further why these people are shying away from these subjects. And then, of course, I watched the JFK movie by Oliver Stone. And I'd always been, I hate to say it, somebody that felt that Lee Harvey Oswald had done it. I never really looked into it. And Oliver Stone, in with his brilliant cinematography, basically convinced me that there was more to it. Simple things like, yeah, why didn't the shooter go after Kennedy when he was coming towards the Texas School Book Depository on Houston? Why didn't he shoot at him? Why did he wait for him to go by him, you know, and then have to shoot through a tree? And why did he choose the Mannlicher Carcano, a horrible weapon that the Italian infantry referred to as the humane weapon and that it spared so many lives during the war? And why did he have a weapon that had a defective scope that... Why didn't he adjust it? You know, he was shooting at a president. These things really bothered me, and I began to really research them. And I think the things that really turned me were the same things that did David Talbot. Talbot had indicated before he wrote the book Brothers that he had never been much of a conspiracy guy. And one of the things that had always bothered him, Len, was the fact that Robert Kennedy didn't seem to be concerned about who killed his brother. His public statements were supportive of the Warren Commission. And then when he started to research it, he realized Oh my God, Robert Kennedy didn't agree with the Warren Commission at all. He was investigating his brother's murder and was planning to reopen the investigation if he got elected president. It blew his mind. And then the second thing that really blew his mind was the fact that the Kennedys were essentially at war with the national security state. And it just got worse and worse as each year went by. And that changed his whole perspective, and it also did me as well. And then, of course, I had the good fortune of stumbling over shows like yourself, you know, Black Op Radio. I heard James Ciesegno and others talk about the assassination. I started buying their books, and it started to turn me. And the more I learned, the more I wanted to know. And then there was a part of me that just said that, you know, I really want to put all this down and write about it. And I wrote my first book, The Paradox of Our National Security Complex. And then I wrote this book, Rethinking America. And that's how I got into it. It was sort of a cathartic thing for me, as therapeutic in a way, to write it down and to express how disappointed I was and disillusioned with the way the country had turned out. You know, essentially in a nutshell, you know, there was a battle that went on that we were completely unaware of when I was growing up between the Dulles brothers and the Kennedys, and the Kennedys lost. And the reality we live in today is basically the reality that the Dulles brothers wanted.
Yeah. You know, the Bank of Boston working for Sullivan Cromwell.
Yes.
It's, when you think about South America, it's quite a legacy of deceit that the Dulles brothers through the CIA have left. And I forget what one of your chapters are, but something to the effect that capitalism really is the problem here because there's a flaw in it. And, here it is. Has capitalism revealed its innate flaw that, you know, unless you can keep taking advantage of somebody, you can't keep this pyramid scheme going. I mean, you have to have a constant war and keep borrowing money to fund this industrialized military complex. And now they are inventing the wars and the national security. I mean, that seems to be the be all that, you know, we can't tell you. And with, you know, thanks to a little bit of, you know, Edward Snowden, that people can say, well, they are spying on everybody and what they're doing. They don't want anybody to see what they're doing. Or it would, if people woke up, you know, it starts with the JFK assassination, that they really covered up stuff, and Alan Dulles said, don't worry, people don't read. And even if we print
yes.
the stuff we've got here. So you were influenced by Oliver Stone's film, JFK, and that really kind of lifted the lid where you started reading, you know, you'd see somebody on TV, as you mentioned, talking about the agency or what American foreign policy is, and then you look into it for yourself and you find out, no, this isn't it. I mean, I'm always appalled the name escapes me. Those military contractors, I can't think of the right name.
Yeah, the defense contractors that are making so much money at our expense while we were bombing all these countries and removing their governments and creating failed states like Libya and Iraq, and we're trying to do it in Syria, and we're doing it in Yemen, and we're doing it in Afghanistan, and we're doing it in Somalia, and we got wars going on in Central Africa that nobody even knows anything about, and the mainstream media don't report on any of it.
Right. Well, I was thinking of it used to be called Blackwater, I believe, but
yes, the private
right
contractor
so military people get out of the military and they're hired here for big money. And they're going, they're causing all these problems that are requiring a U.S. military foreign policy to go, we've got to go in here and clean up stuff that really, in essence, they started.
Yes. Well, I mean, Blackwater, the abuses that they had, I mean, if you remember, they had entertainment that was in an Orwellian way labeled as something very obscure and nebulous and even legitimate, and it really was. They were just flying in prostitutes, and they were the line item was $1 million. And not only that, these Blackwater private contractors, they were being paid six figures to be there, while our soldiers who were risking their lives were being barely paid middle class wages. And it's just, and then not only that, they come home and they don't really get the services they were promised. I've worked with a number of them. Some of them are denied services. Some of them, they receive very nominal services. And, for example, a real shocking thing that I discovered the other day is I met somebody who was a social worker from Los Angeles, and she was working in Belfast, Maine. And we talked about the 10 cities in Los Angeles, and she said, you know, a lot of them are veterans.
Yeah, it's shocking to look at that. And you hear, I think it's 22 servicemen a day commit suicide.
Yes, that is right. It's terrible.
Yeah. So for what were they trained to do, and what did they end up doing? Well, look, let's talk about a couple specific things. One I wanted to get to was your chapter 4 entitled The Secret Government and Its Threat to Our Democratic Republic. Maybe discuss just a little bit a secret government in from your point of view.
The secret government is essentially the intelligence agencies, all 17 intelligence agencies, and part of our military, in which everything that they do is essentially classified. They don't really follow the classification rules. I mean, they classify what they have for lunch. And they've used the classification system as a shield to protect them from all the nefarious activities that they're engaged in, including war crimes. And they're not elected. Most of the public, unless they've researched it like you and I, don't even know who these people are. And they don't even know the historical figures that have held some of these positions, like David Attlee Phillips or James Jesus Angleton or David Sanchez Morales or William Harvey or any of those people from the past, or even some of the people that are in there now. And of course, we wouldn't know about half of the things if it wasn't for WikiLeaks or the whistleblowers that are unveiling some of the things that they're doing behind closed doors, such as the torture program. John Carioca risked his liberty and served 3 years in prison because he became a whistleblower and told the American public that this was going on. And the person, one of the people that was using the torture program to achieve her objectives, Gina Haspel, was rewarded and became CIA director. But the secret government, essentially, to me, are those people that operate in secrecy, that are protected under the umbrella of the national security complex. And no one, including the Congress and in some cases the president, knows what they're really doing out in the field.
Yeah, you said including the president. This seems to be a constant thread where, plausible deniability, just don't tell the boss, we know what he wants done, and we'll go do that. Or worse, they're working on behalf of big corporations.
Yes.
That have been funding the Pentagon. And you find out these admirals and generals, when they're retired, they're on the board of directors of half of these corporations in America.
Yes. Alan Dulles, when he was appointed the CIA director, as you pointed out earlier, he was a managing partner along with his brother and Sullivan and Cromwell. And he knew all the corporate conglomerates. He knew the CEOs personally. He socialized with them. His brother socialized with them. He even knew the companies that were rising in power in Nazi Germany. He'd met with all them. He felt quite comfortable with them. And, when he took over the CIA, he took it in a much different direction. He was more interested in the clandestine services than the analytical side. And he ignored the analytical side to a large extent. And he created a culture of duplicity and lying and, in their desire to achieve absolute power and create an empire for the United States. Part of creating that empire and maintaining the CIA's role in all this is that he formed alliances with the media, Operation Mockingbird, and, of course, all these corporate giants that he knew a lot of the people that were running them, whether it was United Fruit or others. And the CIA basically, whenever these companies needed help, they went in and they overthrew governments that were impeding their profits. And you've had people on your show, including James Eugenio and others, that talked about this a lot, about, you know, the overthrow of Mossadegh in Iran and how he was nationalizing the oil industry. And, you know, the companies complained to the MI6 and the CIA, and they went in there and they overthrew them. And the same thing in Guatemala with United Fruit and other places like Indonesia, and the list goes on and on. And essentially, these social democrats were trying to keep the money in the country that was they were getting from these natural resources that were theirs, that were in their sovereign territory, and to utilize them to help rebuild their country and build a middle class and to improve the standard of living for their citizens. Well, that's a shocking thing for a government to want to do, and that's what they were doing. But essentially, they were stepping on toes that were very powerful and were used to getting their way and making lots of money at the expense of these small countries. And the CIA basically was supporting all that and overthrowing these governments so these companies could continue to exploit the natural resources in those countries. And they replaced these social democracies with brutal dictatorships. Like the Shah of Iran, and of course, Pinochet in Chile. And Alan Dulles pretty much set the tone and the social structure within the CIA that we've been dealing with ever since.
Yeah, and I had interviewed John Perkins, who'd written a book just about that called Confessions of an Economic Hitman.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And he really itemizes how all these things are done. And they kind of trick a nation into debt. And then they say, unless you don't give us your bananas or whatever, your exports for next to nothing, and then if they don't, if that government's overthrown, they put in, like you say, liberal people who want to look after their own people, raise the standard of living for their own citizens, those guys are overthrown or worse, assassinated.
And yes, well, he basically pointed out that Iraq was the best example of all three scenarios for economic assassination of a country. For example, he was the first phase. He'd go in there and try to get them to buy into an IMF loan and get them in debt, knowing that at some point they would have trouble paying that loan off. And then they would use that as leverage to say, hey, we'll help you out with the loan if you let these people get access to your natural resources. And so they get their foot in the door. And then, of course, Saddam Hussein said, no, get out of here. I'm all set. I don't need your loans. And so, they send in the jackals. And then and Saddam Hussein had such good security around him, they couldn't get near him to assassinate him. And then, of course, the last phase is sending in the military and creating a pretext to overthrow them. And that's what he said happened in Iraq. Now, you can see this in more subtle ways, although they're getting less and less transparent. They're becoming so bold because they feel like they're impervious to attack at this point. But you can see it in Venezuela, and you can see it in Bolivia. Where, these countries, they try to get them to buy into loans and they don't want the loans and they're independent. And then they try to kill them like Maduro. He was on the stage there and they tried to blow him up on the stage and it didn't work. And there's been discussion on counter-narrative YouTube channels indicating that the CIA and American intelligence might have been involved in that or supporting the groups that tried to kill him. So you can see these things playing out that John Perkins talked about in his book, A Confessions of an Economic Assassin.
Yeah, it reminds me of Edward Snowden because he's lifting the lid. He didn't, he gave you a hint of what was going on with some detail, but it's, in my experience, worse than even they're letting us know about. They're just trying to warn people that you should be on, this should be on your radar. It's the kind of thing that I found the thread going through your book that it's just case after case where you have to start looking into these things And it's a real disappointment in a way to think you think that someone is working on behalf of, I mean, outside of John Kennedy, which I think a lot of people thought that he was working on behalf of Americans and then the world. You know, we live together, we breathe the same air, drink the same water. We've got to start getting along. And he's assassinated, and they blame Lee Oswald, and they try to tell
Yes.
everybody to, you know, to go back to sleep. So it's, you know, a few of us
Well, you
are
know,
waiting to blend.
it started a long time ago, but it really, I think the lines were drawn when Roosevelt got into power. And of course, General Smedley Butler talked about the coup that was attempted. They tried to enlist him in their operation, and he basically maintained contact with them until he could figure out or have some general understanding of what they were trying to do. And the New Deal was a major threat to the capitalists, to the people that were making all kinds of money and benefiting from the status quo. And they some of them, I think, convinced themselves that the New Deal was a form of communism. But in essence, capitalism, as you pointed out, its innate flaw is that if you just have pure capitalism, it turns into a Darwinist principle in which there's a survival of the richest and everyone else is just trying to survive with just the breadcrumbs that are left behind by those few that become super rich. And the whole system at some point collapses in on itself because you have no more customers to buy your products, or you have an uprising of some kind. It can be violent or it can be peaceful, but in many cases throughout history, it's become violent. And the New Deal threatened a lot of people, and Roosevelt was able to maintain power for 12 years. And when he died, they took advantage of his death, and Harry Truman, who I think made some major mistakes and concessions that he later regretted, such as creating the CIA. But more importantly, he signed that National Security Act that sort of reformulated our whole national security complex. He created the NSC and reoriented the military, so now it was, controlled by a Secretary of Defense instead of a Secretary of War, and created the formalized the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and all these things that were created that sort of was the birthplace of this national security complex that sort of dominates our society now. And by the time Kennedy came into power, Eisenhower, he warned us about this military-industrial complex, but at the same token, he sort of created the mess that he was handing over to JFK, and he was handing him a legacy of ashes. He gave him all these hotspots and problems that JFK recognized that I'm not going to be able to pursue some of the things I wanted to do because I'm going to have to deal with these messes. And the first year of his administration was essentially trying to figure out a way to navigate through all these messes that were left behind by the Eisenhower administration in Laos, Cuba, and Vietnam. And he too made some concessions, but fortunately he held his ground. And every time he held his ground, they got they began to view him as a Cold War traitor. An appeaser, just like his they thought his father was, and they began to distrust him more and more and more, and began to engage in more and more rogue operations to try to undermine his policies. And then Kennedy, in order to counter them, he had to engage in his own ruses, his own little clandestine back channel diplomacy to try to get around them. It was just in a very dangerous situation that somehow President Kennedy was able to stay on top of and stay in control until obviously Dealey Plaza, when they finally decided that this was the only way to change the course and maintain the vision that they wanted, which was to build an empire. President Kennedy basically wanted us to be an exemplary nation, not an exceptional nation, that just used its power and influence to enforce a Pax Americana on the rest of the world by our weapons of war. He wanted us to be an example culturally, intellectually, and in our science and our arts, as a leader in the world, and use our power to improve the standard of living for people all around the world, and to fight for peace. All that, and so, you know, when he was killed, they had to erase all that and to change his image. And that's part of the lie and the poison that we're now living with today, that's still affecting us. Because, you know, most people, even some of my friends, won't even list President Kennedy as a liberal or progressive administration. And yet you can point out to them and they still don't aren't willing to listen to you. They still resist what you're trying to tell them, that the Great Society basically was mostly Kennedy policies that Johnson passed. And so how can you say he wasn't a progressive president when the whole Great Society, most of it was his initiatives, his programs that he was pushing through at the end of his life? And so, you know, Kennedy's assassination is a seminal moment because it really brought to the forefront this power struggle that for the most part had been hidden. And the American people really wasn't privy to any of it. And I don't think that they, even after the Kennedy assassination, they really appreciated what was going on until the 70s, when everything came out in the Church Committee and the Pike Committee and the Rockefeller Foundation and the House Select Committee on Assassinations. All those things brought it all out into the open. And of course, Watergate as well.
Well, you know, from my point of view, two things that happened were that the Warren Commission came and said it was a lone assassin and the guy shot him. And then a leaked film, Robert Groden, put out on, what's his name, Geraldo Rivera. Anyway, on TV, right? So that people saw that. And I think bootlegs of that were going around from university to university. And people had seen, no, he shot from the front. What the hell have I been, you know, how many lies have I got into? And then if people look into it at all, if they start reading any little bit of the Warren Commission, you start realizing, well, this doesn't add up. I mean, it culminated with Jim Garrison reading it and doing something about it. Not too many people. There's Mark Lane. There was a few people that were doing something. And Jim Garrison's effort, I mean, at least he wasn't shot and killed in a back alley. But, you know, he made a very valiant effort, more than most. And, you know, that's, I think, what inspired Oliver's story. But that's the thing that, you know, you've got a chapter here called Amnesty Has Overtaken the Nation. And that's kind of the thing that you get at, that you're asleep unless you really look into this stuff. And when you look into it, it's maybe such a shock that it's too uncomfortable to go too much very deep into it.
Well, you know, it's like when at first, you know, I was kind of offended by some of my friends from my first book, The Paradox of Our National Security Complex, because that book, the chapter 3 is about the Kennedy assassination. And in chapter 4, I discuss about some of the dissenters in society, in which I mentioned James Garrison, Colonel Leroy Fletcher Prouty, which I understand you admire very much and was a very important figure in terms of teaching us what was really going on at that time. And then, of course, Abraham Bolden and Oliver Stone. They were dissenters in our society, and they forced us to see things that we didn't really want to see, that we were kind of resistant. And in some ways, as Dr. E. Martin Schultz said, we were in denial. But the thing is that I wanted to point out is that I was thinking about it. And, you know, essentially, my friends basically believed in their reality was based on a lie. And, you know, to confront the fact that you're living in a lie is extremely stressful event with a lot of anxiety associated with it. And the only way I can equate that and bring it to someone's an understanding in which somebody can relate to is that it's the same feeling that you had when you watched the towers go down on 9/11 And I'm sure you felt that way even as a Canadian citizen, as we watched the towers go down in 9/11 and our whole reality was tipped on its head, and that we weren't secure and safe. And these things weren't only happening over there. And those towers that we thought were symbols of American financial well-being and would be there for a long time, maybe 100, 200 years, were gone in a matter of minutes. And that, you know, if you remember that anxiousness that you felt in your gut and, you know, that bothered you for several days after that event, that's the way my friends felt about my book, in my opinion. You know, they couldn't handle it. Our country doesn't kill its president. That's not the way it goes. We don't kill our civil rights leaders. We didn't kill his brother. Are you kidding me? You're a paranoid lunatic. You know, they basically accused me of being a conspiracy theorist, and you know how that goes, right? But I was initially offended by it, but then I realized that I was asking them to come to these conclusions when I had 30 years of research, and they had to come to these conclusions and realizations. You know, from the beginning of reading page one until the end of my book, that they had to do all that in the 300 pages of my first book, and it overwhelmed them, and they just weren't willing to be open enough to take it in. And I think a lot of people resist these things. It's sort of like what Dr. E. Martin Schultz said. You know, we can suspect or what's the word I want? We can think that it might be a possibility, but it's a lot different when you know something is true, because then you have an obligation to do something about it and to reorient your whole thinking about the subject. And of course, that leap is very stressful for most people. So you can talk to a lot of people that might go, yeah, I'm not sure that Lee Harvey Oswald did it by himself. Yeah, there may have been a couple of shooters. But then you start saying that it's rogue elements within the CIA and our government and maybe military people like General Curtis LeMay had foreknowledge of it. Then you're starting to get into areas where they're very uncomfortable.
Yeah, And your word for that was amnesia, because then people just kind of gloss over and they can't handle it. And they say, well, it can't be true. And even if it was true, I don't know what that means. It was a long time ago, you know.
But it's not really relevant to their present world. So why do you even worry about it? Or they feel powerless. They decide, hey, I can't do anything about Kennedy, you know. So why should I worry about it? But most of them can't even accept the fact that, I mean, they could accept the mafia did it. They can accept that maybe Castro was involved, but they can't accept that our own parts of our own government, even if it was rogue elements, were involved in it. And they can't accept the fact that the rest of the government, in order to maintain the integrity of the government, to prevent a rebellion, and potentially, as some were told, a third world war, felt it was in their patriotic duty to cover it all up. And, you know.
Well, that's why I don't think it was rogue.
Yeah, well, I mean, the rogue elements that I'm saying is that when you, you know how you've even said it on your show at times, it's not the CIA that killed Kennedy, the whole CIA. I mean, Ray McGovern was on the analytical side, and he joined the CIA because he was inspired by Kennedy's inaugural address to serve his country. And he was working in the CIA at the time. It was elements within the CIA that were extremists, that were neo-fascists and elitists, and they thought that they knew what was best for the country better than our elected officials did. And they were determined to maintain their power, and Kennedy threatened their power. And so they decided to come up with a plan to get rid of him, because they realized by 1963 that he was probably going to win the election. I know some people said, well, how do you say that? You know, it's counterfactual history. And he had lost some approval rating because of his submission of the Civil Rights Bill. But, you know, the approval rating he had, even though he dropped 20 points after submitting the civil rights bill, was still in the high 50s. Most of our presidents in the last 30 years would do a jig if they got to 50%. And not only that, Kennedy's approval ratings were starting to climb back up. His peace message was actually resonating with people. And that I think that shocked the military. I think they, you know, they thought their message that we had to fight the communists, we couldn't negotiate with them, that the only way to win this war was through military action and containment. And I think that they were caught a little by surprise that Kennedy's peace message really resonated with the people. And he turned the whole country around. If you remember, the Senate was overwhelmed. Limited test ban treaty, and by the end of the summer, they voted overwhelmingly in favor of it. I think an 80-12 vote or something. The American people were very supportive of that treaty. And then he had the wheat grain agreement, where the generals are going, "Oh my God, he's feeding the enemy! What the heck's this guy doing?" And then he'd signed National Security Action Memorandum 263, and has actually decided. We're getting out by 1965, and I think they decided they couldn't wait to the 64 election. And not only that, they didn't see Barry Goldwater or any Republican challenging him with any real shot of winning. And so they took the drastic step, and I say rogue elements within the government took the drastic step of getting rid of him.
Yeah. Well, your book is chapter 12 right now. A Bitter Harvest. Do you want to just briefly discuss that?
Well, I mean, the Bitter Harvest basically is, you know, the Kennedy family has contributed to a lot in our country. And they were a very wealthy family that could have stayed out of politics and just enjoyed their lives and used their wealth to just frolic around the world and, you know, go sailing and eating good food. But no, they, public service was an important part of being a Kennedy, was serving the public and the country and trying to make it a better place for people to live in. And, you know, but they, because of the things that they stood for and the things that they were doing, they developed some very powerful enemies over time. And they created a lot of these perfidious narratives that a lot of people consider absolute truths, you know, lies masquerading as truths. Two of which have to do with Joseph Kennedy Sr., which I start out about, is that he made a lot of his wealth bootlegging during the 20s, which is an outright lie. And it was even in The Irishman, you know, that's based on some of these mob books. And I haven't read James Eugenio's articles on that movie, but as I was watching it with my family, I said, that's a lie. He never did that. You know, and if you read my book, or I can prove that's a lie. And then the other one was that he had made an alliance with Sam Giancana and the mob to help his son win the presidency. And I think in my essay, I prove, if not prove beyond a reasonable doubt, I should make people very skeptical of that, because just look at the way the Kennedys operated. Robert Kennedy was appointed as the chief counsel for the McClellan Committee, or the Ratcliffe Committee, in 1957. This is before the so-called deal that Joseph P. Kennedy Sr. had with Sam Giancana. And he's like, you know, these people are being subpoenaed before that committee, and he's ripping them, you know, left and right, and tells Giancana when he laughed and pleaded the fifth, that I thought only little girls giggled, Mr. Giancana. Can you imagine these people wanted to strangle and kill him at that point? You think they're going to, like, support the Kennedys? And John Kennedy was on that committee, and he was asking some very tough questions, too. To think that they would overlook all that, you know, it's just illogical. And not only that, Robert Kennedy wrote a very condemning book about the mob called The Enemy Within during the campaign, Len. He wrote that during the campaign, and he basically ripped them apart. He said that they were one of the most dangerous things that faced the country. And they're going to support President Kennedy? It just does not make sense. It doesn't pass the smell test. It's illogical. To bring it into modern perspective and modern issues, it's just like the chemical weapons attacks that Assad allegedly did in 2013, 17, and 18. He's winning the war conventionally. The worst thing he could do to shake the hornet's nest of the West would be to drop chemical weapons on his people. I mean, and these chemical weapons don't even have any really military advantage to the conventional weapons that are killing just as many people. So why would he do that? You know, he went to medical school. He's been a leader of Syria for a long time. It just is completely illogical. And now here we have the OPCW's engineering report. We got two whistleblowers. We got an MIT professor who's an expert in these matters, a scientist, Theodore Postol, talking about the engineering report. And it's clear that the whole event, at least the April 2018 event, was staged. And, so these narratives persist, and a lot of this stuff are simply lies, and it's just not logical that the mob would overlook all the things that the Kennedy brothers were doing to them just because of a promise from Kennedy Sr. And not only that, when they got into power, they didn't give them anything. President Kennedy just said, hey, you're going to go after the mob, go to it. And Bobby Kennedy upped the prosecutions against mobsters 400 to 800%, depending on the study you're looking at. And no attorney general since him and no attorney general prior to him has ever gone after organized crime as zealously as he did. And so it just doesn't make any sense. I just go through these points. Like, for example, most progressives today wouldn't consider Kennedy a liberal administration yet. I think I showed that all the legislation that he was pushing and fighting for were very progressive pieces of legislation, and he left a very positive legacy. And he certainly, in my opinion, if you compare him to Jimmy Carter, who's a wonderful man, but he, when he was president, his agenda wasn't that progressive. And if you look at Ronald Reagan or George H.W. Bush, or you look at Bill Clinton, all the way to the present, he's really the last progressive president we've had in the last 60 years.
Yeah, when you think of the speeches he gave about U.S. Steel, about so many of these things where he was fighting for the common man, it's a real eye-opener. And the more you learn about him and his foreign policy, especially with Africa that Jim DiEugenio is writing about and doing research, the more you find out about him, the more I have a respect for him, where that's really failed America. Every one of their presidents is, they haven't all left in disgrace, but it's a different topic, but, back to the title, Rethinking America, that this is something that if you just watch the news or watch Fox News, even CNN to some degree, right, and CBS, I mean, Dan Rather, can't believe he's still working anywhere, but that music station.
Yeah, you think of Dan Rather, I don't know what film he was looking at, but you remember what he reported, what the Zapruder film showed, was that Kennedy violently went forward.
Yeah.
Now,
John Barber's documentary, he has that actual footage.
Yes, that was a great thing that he did, because he brought all those things together to show how the media, and how Operation Mockingbird was working to a T, About 40 minutes into the assassination, they changed their whole tune, and they all were aligned with this. It was a lone nut who had communist affiliations, where prior to that, you know, they were entertaining the idea that there might have been a shooter on the grassy knoll and so forth. But after that first 40 minutes went by, boy, that the narratives changed quite rapidly and quite consistently across the board. And I think that was indicative of how strong the alliance was between the CIA and the mainstream media under Operation Mockingbird, which we learned about during the Church Committee hearings over a decade later. But I mean, Dan Rather, that statement just epitomizes it. He either was told what the film showed by somebody that was lying to him, or he blatantly went out there and lied about what the Zapruder film showed, because anybody looking at the Zapruder film would not, the first thing that comes to mind wouldn't say that he violently went forward. You know, but, you know, I think the Zapruder film is a very powerful piece of evidence because it restricted what the Warren Commission was able to do. You imagine if there was no film, they could have gotten away with all kinds of things and to push their lone nut scenario. But that film put them in a vice, which forced them to come up with this fiction called the single bullet theory. And I think, I don't know how you feel about it, Len, or James Eugenio, but I think Sherry Feister had it right. And if, in my mind, the kill shot came from the South Knoll, because if you look at the trajectory, he clearly was turned 20 degrees to his left with his head slightly tilted down, and the bullet went in and then to the right side of his forehead, and a slightly downward angle went down and then blew out the lower part of his occipital part of his skull. And as it, you know, it hit the back of his head, it pushed him back. And then when it blew out to the, if you were facing Kennedy slightly to the left, it forced him to obviously go back and to the left. And I think that accurately, she accurately described using 21st forensic information and knowledge and techniques, how that happened. I think that, not to go off on a tangent, but I think there was the thing I can't really wrap my head around is that the acoustic evidence in Daley Plaza basically indicated that, you know, there were five shots. The House Select Committee on Assassinations expert panel that they assembled felt that there were five shots on that Dictabelt recording that was done by an open mic on a motorcycle operated by a Dallas police officer during the motorcade. And then, of course, Dr. Donald Thomas in 2003, using 21st century technology, affirmed that original panel for the House Select Committee in 1978. And in both analyses, they couldn't determine where the fifth shot came from. But I think there were six shots. And this is why I think there's six shots in this, and I'm speculating here, but I think the mic, and maybe you know more about this, the mic on that motorcycle was on the right-hand side, and so it was facing the grassy knoll. So it captured all the shots on the grassy knoll and just behind the president, you know, in the Dow Tech building and the Texas School Book Depository. But the motorcycle and the officer blocked its ability to hear with any distinction that would enable people to determine that there was a shot from the South Knoll. So what I think happened was, and I could be wrong, but there was, as you know, the two out of the three shell casings that were found at that sixth floor window were not fired that day. One of them was dry loaded, as Jim DiGenio eloquently points out in his book Reclaiming Parkland and his new book, The JFK Assassination. And there was only one shell casing that was fired from that Mannlicher Carcano rifle that day, that the you know, at 12:30 p.m. on that November 22nd. And so what I think happened was that they had to fire something from that rifle, you know, just so they had a shell casing from that rifle. But the rifle basically was useless because it was a crappy rifle to begin with, and the scope was defective. It wasn't aligned with the barrel of the gun. So they just fired one of the shots just so to attract some attention to that window. And then that shot went and hit a curb on Main Street that hit James Tague in the cheek. And then, you know, everyone thought that was a firecracker and they were looking around. And what I think happened next was the President Kennedy got hit in the back from another shooter that might have been using a Mauser that was also found in the sixth floor. From another window on that sixth floor, he hit President Kennedy, as Sherry Feister said, at a 38.84 degree angle, which would be consistent with a 60-foot elevation, which is a sixth-floor window. And then I think Kennedy was hit in the throat from somebody that was in the frontal part near the triple overpass on the grassy knoll. And it was a zero-degree hit, according to Sherry Feister. So the shooter had to be at the same elevation as Kennedy's neck. So they were lower towards the street. And then when Kennedy got hit in the throat, as you know, the famous part of that film, his arms come up and he starts to grasp his throat, but he also leans to his left. And I think it was Bradington was that mob guy that was picked up coming out of the Dell Tech building, but he gave a false name and so they let him go. He was on a second floor window, and he fired shortly after the wound in the neck, that bullet. He fired very closely. As Lee Bowers Jr. said, those two shots were so close together, he thought that they were from different weapons. And the Warren Commission people said, oh, you're not an expert. You can't talk about that stuff. But anyways, because Kennedy moved to his left and started to lean in that direction, that bullet from the Dell Tech building just missed him and went into John Connolly's back at a 22-degree angle. And while this was happening, I think somebody from the grassy knoll, who was trying to time his shot perfectly as Kennedy came from behind the Stemmons Freeway sign, misjudged it just by a little bit. And I think his bullet missed, as the House Select Committee on Assassination said, and as Dr. Donald Thomas said, that shot missed, and it hit the Stemmons Freeway sign and then ricocheted into the street and then onto the grass, in the center of Daley Plaza. And that's why they removed the Stemmons Freeway sign, because there was evidence of a bullet shot through there that had to have come from the grassy knoll, which they didn't want anyone to know about. And then, of course, as President Kennedy's leaning forward, and then the driver of the limousine, I forget his name right now, he turned to look over his right shoulder and he put the brakes on. And in a couple of pictures, you can see the lights of the brakes on the limousine coming on. And he put the brakes on and slowed the limousine down about 9 miles per hour. And that's when the guy from the South Knoll got him in his sights, because Kennedy, for professional mechanics, was a sitting duck at this point. And he lined him up and he shot him and killed him. And then, of course, the limousine took off. So I think those were the six shots. And I think the explanation of why the acoustic evidence doesn't pick up on that sixth shot is where the mic on the motorcycle was located prevented it from being able to really pick up on that shot from the South Knoll. But that's speculation on my part, and that's the way I felt it happened. That's how many shots I think occurred in Daley Plaza.
Well, it's amazing they even have that tape and they were able to try to recreate by getting the acoustical fingerprint, taking shots in Daley Plaza and recording them and trying to look at them on a waveform graph, right, to say, well, here, this
yes.
is a, you know, impulse, something happened here, here, and here. So even that's
yes.
amazing, right?
Yeah. And, you know, I don't know how much you want to talk about Russiagate, but what did you think about William Binney? Were you aware of William Binney before you read my book, or had you watched him be interviewed on the Jimmy Dore show or other alternative media?
Yeah, I had seen alternative media, several interviews, and there's a couple of documentaries. I'm not sure if Laura Poitras did one on him as well, but I've seen several. I did know about William Biddy. I mean, that's why I was so familiar with your writing, because I hadn't known a lot. And like you say, you watch a TV show or a movie, and you it happens to me with my family. Oh, that's a lie. No, he's not telling the truth at all, and other people have to rely, on your word or but there's so much of it. There's just so much of it. And even I don't want to get too much into Russiagate because I want to I just wanted to have you on and just talk about the book and get in, influence people to pick it up. And we'll get into that in a second. But I mean, it's the same thing that when somebody made the quote, we all know we have succeeded when no one can count on, and I forget the quote, but we know we will have succeeded when no one knows what to believe, when there's so
Yeah,
much.
William Casey said that at a National Security Council meeting, talking about their propaganda about the Soviet Union.
Yeah, I butchered that quote, but you recognize it, right? And so that's the thing, right?
Well, all of us, it's tough to remember all these names and everything because, the Kennedy thing becomes so complex that it deters a lot of people from looking into it. And the topography in many cases is intentionally made in a way, created in a way that nobody recognizes anything and they just get lost in it and overwhelmed and they just back away. And that's what I think the intelligence community wanted, to create all this wilderness of mirrors so that nobody really could understand what was there. But and that's why it's amazing that the determined citizens such as Mark Lane and Jim Garrison and Colonel Leroy Fletcher Prouty after he left government, and Abraham Bolden, as a Secret Service agent, and others, that and James Eugenio and Lisa Peace, that were so determined that they were able to see these stubborn facts that remained in spite of all the obfuscation and the fog and the mist and everything that was out there, that trying to confuse these people, and they were able to piece it together in a way that inspired people like me to look at the evidence and change my mind in the end.
Yeah, there's a good documentary about 9/11 called Loose Change that was started by two or three guys that they thought that, they will expose the failings of the people who are criticizing and giving critique of what happened on 9/11. And as they get into it further, they're just amazed that no, there's something wrong here. And further, we're going right down the rabbit hole. I mean, this could be a
Well,
self-inflicted attack.
the 9/11 Commission, they complained that the government wasn't really cooperating with them either. Just like the Warren Commission had issues, and some of the members, like Richard Russell and Hale Boggs, he told James Garrison that Hale Boggs told James Garrison that he didn't think the Secret Service, the CIA, or the FBI were telling the truth, and they were holding something back and they were lying to them. And I think some of the 9/11 Commission people felt the same way. I'm not one of these people, and I can't say that I've investigated it as well as I did the JFK assassination, that seminal event in our history. But I think that the two things that the government is trying to hide, one of them has to do with William Binney. William Binney created this surveillance program called Thin Thread. But it was different than the surveillance programs that the NSA ended up going with because he was looking for the needle in the haystack. And so he created these algorithms that would allow him to identify chatter that might be of interest to the NSA to prevent things like 9/11 from occurring. The NSA didn't want that. They wanted to collect everything, they wanted all of it. Dick Cheney was pushing for that. Robert Mueller of the FBI was pushing for that. They wanted everything collected. And of course, William Binney said, if you collect everything, you just overwhelm your analysts and they can't see anything. And that's what happened in 9/11. And his thin thread program, William Binney is adamant that if it was in effect during 9/11, they would have spotted the chatter and they might have been able to prevent it. And I think the government is trying to hide that fact that through their own desire for power and their desire to collect everything on the American people and eviscerating the Fourth Amendment and other amendments in our Constitution in order to get this, was a huge power grab, that they essentially, through their desire for power, allowed this horrific event to occur that could have been prevented. The other thing that I think they're trying to hide is that the Saudi Arabian government, not rogue elements within the government itself is funding a lot of these jihadist groups, including Al-Qaeda, that ended up creating this horrific plan that caused the deaths of several thousand people on 9/11. And they're trying to hide that because they're supposedly our big ally, you know, to counter the balance in the Middle East with Iran. And we give them hundreds of billions of dollars in weaponry. And the ironic thing, you know, go back to Kennedy. Kennedy knew in his time, he despised the Saudi Arabian dictatorship. He didn't even want to meet with their leaders unless he was forced to. In fact, he wanted to, I think Jim Giugenio said that he was interested in forming more of a alliance with Nasser of Egypt and moving away from Saudi Arabia. So to go back to 9/11, I think they're trying to hide the fact. And that's one of the reasons why Tulsi Gabbard has gotten into so much trouble, because she's brought out some of these issues that they're trying to suppress. And one of them is the Saudi Arabians' support and financing of all these jihadist groups that allegedly were fighting in this war on terror.
Well, you talk about amnesia. I mean, bin Laden, Saudi Arabian, 17 of the 20 hijackers, whatever the exact number was,
yes.
Saudi Arabian. I mean,
yes.
And then they go into Iraq and Afghanistan. And
yep.
And the royal family, relatives of the bin Ladens, were flown, when every plane was grounded, they were flown out. So everyone in America is just looking away, like from the elephant in the room. Well, look,
yes,
I wanted to just quickly ask you about the title, Rethinking
yes.
America. How did you come up with the title, and what was your thinking that you had to rethink?
Well, as I pointed out in the preface, growing up, I saw things in very much black and white about my country, and I thought that the mistakes that we made were based on ignorance, and they were legitimate mistakes made in good faith by honorable men and women that were in our government, and that basically we were the good guys, and that the evil people that we were fighting were just dark, very dangerous countries that we had to fight against them. Otherwise, our liberty and everything would be taken away from us eventually. And so I kind of believed in that black and white analysis, and I became more sophisticated over time as I, and was somewhat enlightened in the 1970s, even as a teenager, because I watched a lot of those, the ones that were made public, the church committee hearings, with my father, and I watched the nightly news and saw the highlights from those hearings. And I watched the Watergate hearings. I was familiar with what was going on. I watched what was going on in Vietnam, and it was very disheartening. And some of the seeds of my skepticism were set during that decade with all that activity. And of course, the House Select Committee on Assassinations, I have to admit, I can't remember what I specifically thought about their findings that Martin Luther King and Jack Kennedy's deaths were probably a conspiracy and that the Justice Department should open an investigation on them. I can't remember how I thought about that. But and then of course the Reagan administration kind of awakened me, much like the Trump administration is doing for the youth of today. And I began a process of rethinking what my country was doing abroad and the reputation we were developing and how we weren't fighting for the things that we claim we were fighting for. We seem to be doing the opposite. We're allegedly we're fighting to spread democracy. to fight for human rights, to increase our security at home and our liberty at home. And we were actually doing the opposite, hence the paradox of our national security complex. And then, of course, as I told you before, earlier in our interview, you know, I watched the JFK movie, and I read Dee Brown's book, Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, which I don't know if you've ever read that, but that is a very powerful book about the Indian Wars and about our treatment of the Native Americans and what we did to them. I had a lump in my throat throughout that whole book. It just threw me through a loop. So, you know, I'm reading that book and I'm watching the JFK movie, and I just had to rethink America. It wasn't the country that I thought it was. And I think Jack Kennedy wanted the country to be what I wanted it to be. I think Dr. King wanted a country that was very similar to my vision of my country. I think Bobby Kennedy wanted a vision of the country and a future that would have been more consistent with my ideals as a young man. But those things weren't the reality that we were living in. So I had to rethink my country. And I had to realize that on many occasions, unfortunately, and I hate to say this, we're the bad guy. We're the ones creating the chaos. We're the ones creating all the violence. You know, as Dr. King said in that great speech at the Riverside Church about the Vietnam War, he couldn't tell the, you know, all these people that were suffering in these poor neighborhoods not to engage in violence until he addressed the largest purveyor of violence in the world, which was his own government. And we're engaged in 7 wars right now. We got drones surveying the landscape, terrorizing people, killing innocent people to go after a terrorist here or there. We're undermining social democracies to exploit their resources and to reassert our hegemonic power. And we're trying to push Russia back into you know, the position they were in the 1990s, which was a vanquished country that had no economic power or influence, that we were, that was basically crony capitalism under Yeltsin. And of course, Vladimir Putin is a dangerous person, and he definitely is an authoritarian leader. But at the same token, he was willing to work with us. And I think that this Cold War is completely unnecessary. And it's our policies that have essentially pushed us into this Cold War by unilaterally getting out of treaties that we signed, such as the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty that Bush got out of, the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty that Trump got out of, he's getting out of the treaty with Iran, that one of the few things that Barack Obama did that was, I felt, was good. Barack Obama's another whole story. We could spend a whole show on how disillusioned I was with Barack Obama by the time he left office. But I thought he was going to be the Kennedy of our this generation, and he did the total opposite. But I mean, the country is just, it doesn't represent those things that I think people admired in us when Kennedy was in office. And people will go, oh, you're just a Kennedy admirer. Just watch the films when he went abroad, whether it was Costa Rica, Venezuela, or Mexico, or Germany, or Ireland, or France, or any of the other countries he visited. He was welcomed by thousands, and in some cases hundreds of thousands of people that were throwing confetti that was so thick you could hardly see the limousine. They were proud of America. They wanted us to help lead the world to a better place. They trusted President Kennedy. Now, of course, they also knew that the CIA was running around, but I think they understood that the CIA was doing its own thing and it wasn't at the behest of President Kennedy, and I think that's why they made a distinction between what the CIA was doing, which they were very familiar with and felt the effects of, and what President Kennedy was trying to do. And unfortunately, that vision, you know, that he articulated at Amherst College when he was celebrating the lives and works of Robert Frost. You remember I put that in the Looking Glass essay I did at the end to show people what his vision of America was. And it was very eloquently articulated in that speech. And then showing the America as it is. And clearly, the vision of President Kennedy's is not the vision that we or the reality we live in. It is a reality that the Dulles brothers fought for. It's the reality that the national security people fought for, and that the Wall Street people and the deep state actors wanted. It wasn't the reality that Dr. King or the Kennedys were fighting for. And we lost so much when they were assassinated. And I think they threatened some powerful forces, and that's why they were assassinated. They weren't just random events that occurred, that they were all connected to a much bigger thing that was going on at the time.
Yeah. And not a lone assassin or a lone
gunman. No, they were all connected. There might have been different factions of the deep state that took them out. But, you know, Dr. King, for example, there might have been more FBI and military intelligence and Memphis police involvement, whereas the Kennedys, it clearly was CIA activities. And, of course, Lisa Peace, in her very fine book, A Lie Too Big to Fail, she establishes that it was a Robert Mayhew operation. And who's Robert Mayhew? He was a CIA operative who also worked with Howard Hughes, that reclusive billionaire, who was also a former FBI agent, who was well connected with organized crime. He was right in the middle of everything. But more importantly, he was part of the CIA. They couldn't allow Robert Kennedy to become president. He was investigating his brother's death, and he had come to the conclusion that it wasn't a lone nut, that it was a right-wing conspiracy. Him and Jackie Kennedy had told Khrushchev that that's what they felt. And if he had gotten into the presidency, he would have gone after those guys with the same tenaciousness he went after the mob, and they knew it. And so they could never let him be president of the United States. And they had to kill him in Los Angeles. They didn't want him to become the Democratic nominee, which was more and more looking like he was going to be. Because, correct me if I'm wrong, Len, I think after you became the Democratic nominee, you actually got some Secret Service protection.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even though that didn't matter for Kennedy, President Kennedy and Daley Plaza. But then, you know, his security was pulled back, as Colonel Leroy Fletcher Prouty pointed out in what Vincent Palomara's very fine book, Survivor's Guilt, showed as well, that they didn't follow the Rome Protocol. And what did Colonel Fletcher Prouty say? Whenever the government doesn't follow protocol, there is something up. There's a red flag that there's something wrong. And just to throw in Russiagate, what was the big violator in the protocol that the FBI engaged in? They didn't examine the servers of those computers. That should have been the first thing that they were going to do, because that was the best evidence that if Russia had hacked into those servers and had tried to influence our election, that would have been the best evidence. And yet they allowed some third-rate security company that had a dubious reputation that was hired by the DNC to do it and not even provide them a full report. They gave them a redacted report. That is something the FBI would never accept under normal circumstances. And so I think if Colonel Leroy Fletcher Prouty was alive today, he would say that's a red flag. They're not following basic protocol. That's a red flag.
Well, the book we've been talking about is Rethinking America, Lies Masquerading as Truth. Where can people get your book?
Well, this is independently published. So this particular book, you have to get on Amazon and its subsidiaries. That's where it's sold. And the soft cover version is $16.99. And if you have Kindle Unlimited, it's free. If you want to buy the Kindle version, it's $5.99 on Amazon. My first book, The Paradox of Our National Security Complex, it was published by Cronus Books, a subdivision of John Hunt Publishing, is pretty much on every retailer's site that you can you can look for, Barnes and Noble, Books a Million, as well as Amazon.
Do you have a website?
No, I don't, but I have a Facebook page for both my books, as well as my own personal Facebook page.
Great. We'll find links to that.
If you want to become a friend of mine, it's Richard Otto. There's a picture of me wearing a baseball cap in front of a big bookcase. That's me. And, by becoming a friend of mine, you obviously will get access to those two pages that have to do with my books, including this one, Rethinking America.
Very good, Richard. Well, I encourage people to pick up your book. I found it very interesting. I grieved a lot of it. I understood a lot of it. And I think most people listening to Black Op Radio will have that feeling once they read the book. Anyway, I encourage people to do that and make up their own mind. In the meantime, before we wrap up, is there anything you would like to bring up that we didn't mention?
I'd just like to say that, we didn't talk about the attacks on Tulsi Gabbard, because in many ways, like William Binney, like Julian Assange, we didn't get to talk about him. Like the other whistleblowers, Edward Snowden, Chelsea Manning, John Carioco, I can't remember, Thomas Drake, all these people. Tulsi Gabbard's being attacked by the same group, and they're trying to smear her as a Russian agent, as the candidate of Vladimir Putin, that she loves dictators, and that's why she meets with people like Assad, which shows their ignorance. They don't understand that you have to meet with your adversaries to understand their motivations, to try to figure out what's going on in the world and what they're trying to do and what your common ground with them might be. I think she's I hope that if she doesn't get nominated, which it doesn't look like she will, but I'm so hopeful that Bernie Sanders, if he somehow can survive the criticism that is being thrown his way, that he will put her in his cabinet, either as Secretary of State or Secretary of Defense or National Security Advisor. Because I think she's a very courageous woman who's trying to tell the truth. And because of that, they're attacking her. The other thing I wanted to say is that I admire you, Len. I admire the work that you've done. You've taken a major risk. I don't know why you've done it. You're a Canadian citizen, and you've talked about a lot of dark events that are occurring in the United States, and you seem to be very concerned about it, and I appreciate that. And James Diogenio, who's on your show weekly almost, he's a very courageous man as well, and I learned a lot from both of you and Lisa Peace, and I just wanted to say how much I admire your courage, and we need more people like you and James Eugenio and Lisa Peace to keep up the good fight and to tell the truth so that the lies don't masquerade as truth in our country.
Okay, well, thank you very much for the compliment. And Rethinking America, Lies Masquerading as Truth. I appreciate spending time, and I have to admit, I don't have your first book. I'll have to do that, and I'll get that pretty quick.
Hey, thank you, Len, and thanks for having me.
All right. Good night, Richard.
Good night.